Dimitri, let's get started with Modi's visit, and he's going to talk with Zelensky. How do you find the situation right now, and what is he trying to do, in your opinion?
I have no idea. I think that he's just playing for his home audience as the great peacemaker. I don't think this is results-oriented. He was just in Moscow, and the people in Moscow told him that there will be no negotiations because Russia will not negotiate with terror, which is what the Kiev regime now certainly is after their invasion of the Kursk region. And then he goes to Kiev and talks up peace and tells Zelensky that he should negotiate, enter discussions, whatever. Sounds like nonsense to me. I think that, you know, Modi is playing for the home audience in India, and I don't think that this has anything whatsoever to do with international politics. I can't hear you.
Do you think that Putin didn't know about it, about this visit?
I don't think it matters. Modi is a free person. He goes wherever he wants. If he wants to spend 2 days on a train just to talk to somebody who isn't the president of the Ukraine, he's free to do that. You know, and I don't think Putin is going to be upset. Basically, you know, that might cause a, you know, quizzical look and a raised eyebrow, but no more than that. Basically, people are free to waste their time anytime, any way they want, even by talking to Zelensky.
And when you consider all those preconditions before the peace summit in Switzerland, do you think how much of that is still on the table to negotiate on?
None. The next set of conditions is going to be much harsher. That is always the case with the Russians. They make an offer, you either accept it or you don't. And if you don't, then the next set of conditions is going to be worse for you. That is the Russian way of quote unquote negotiation. And that's how this is going to work.
But we know that at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of negotiations. And I want to know right now, with the current situation in the Kursk region, what's going on in the mind of Russians? What's going on in Russia, and what they're talking about in the domestic media?
The fact that Russian soil has been violated has caused hundreds of thousands of Russian men to look up and pay attention and decide to go and enlist and sign a contract with the military to go and serve. And a lot of these are seasoned veterans who know how to fight. A lot of them have seen action in Syria and have seen action in Chechnya, possibly, and in Georgia. So these are seasoned veterans who know what they're doing. And so I don't think that that's going to make it possible for the Ukraine to stage any more invasions like that. As far as what the actual invasion is, well, it's a new bleeding ground for the Ukrainians. So far, the last numbers I checked is 4,000 some of them died, and hundreds of pieces of equipment have been lost, including lots of tanks. So that doesn't bode well for them either. And what does that mean about negotiation? There's nobody to negotiate with, okay? There's nobody in the West to negotiate with, given the fate of the Minsk agreements. There's nobody in Kiev to negotiate with because the Ukraine no longer has a president as of May 20th, and no longer has a parliament as of August 11th. So there are no legitimate federal authorities to sign any sort of a peace deal. There's nobody for Russia to talk to in Kiev. Nobody. People should really get that through their heads. And so what can the people in Kyiv still do legitimately? Well, they can sign articles of capitulation. They can unconditionally surrender. You can get a stray cat to, make a paw imprint on a document of unconditional surrender, and it would still be valid. And the cat can just go and be wild or whatever, or turned into dog food. Nobody cares. Okay? Different from a peace agreement. Peace agreement means we do this, you do that. Articles of capitulation mean you do whatever we tell you to do at any given moment from now on forever. See the difference? Okay, so what Kyiv is looking for is an opportunity to sign articles of capitulation with Russia. And they'll do that at some point, but not until they've exhausted all of the war material that the West is providing them with, and all of the raw recruits that they're basically plucking off the streets and sending into battle, and most of them surrender. Although that's not going very well, because all the people who are doing the plucking keep getting their cars set on fire, and there's quite a violent reaction on the part of just regular Ukrainians at this point to this mindless slaughter that's going on. 2,000 people a day getting killed for no good reason at all. And as far as the war material, if you look, this is something that is very difficult to get at, this information, but dozens of military factories around Poland and Romania and Germany, and even some in the United States, are catching on fire accidentally. And it's spreading, the tendency is spreading. So already NATO is kind of running dry as far as weapons that they and ammunition and stuff that they can ship to the Ukraine from the Russians to destroy. But that situation is going to get increasingly bad for the Ukrainians. So at some point they will have to surrender. And the extra funny thing is that Putin has promised that the people responsible will be put on trial and will be punished. I'm waiting to see whether Russia lifts its moratorium on the death penalty, because what the Russians have typically done to the fascists is hang them by the neck until dead. And so we'll have to see whether that is what happened, or whether they're just sent to Siberia for the rest of their lives to fell trees, which is also likely. But that is really what we're looking forward to, not any sort of negotiation.
We know that in those preconditions, Russia was eager to talk about Odessa and Nikolaev, these two cities that are so important, that is the access to the Black Sea. Do you think that this attack on the Kursk region would change the mind of Russians in order to any sort of negotiations in the future when it comes to, because it's when they're attacking Kursk region, it seems that in the mind of Russian, they would see Odessa and Nikolaev because they're going to have access to the Black Sea and they're going to be closer to the Crimea to attack any sort of attack. How do you see? Do you think that Russia is considering that and changing their mind on Odessa and Nikolaev?
Well, first of all, there is no mention of Odessa or Nikolaev in the preconditions. None. So Lugansk and Donetsk are mentioned by name, and then Putin, just so that to save time, referred to the rest as Novorussia, which is a traditional way to refer to it. Novorussia includes all of the regions, including Nikolaev and Odessa and Kyiv region and Sumy region and Kharkiv region and Dnipropetrovsk. Why single out just Odessa and Nikolaev? what Putin actually said is that, and he said that at various times, is that the Ukrainian statehood is coming to an end. That the Ukraine as a nation will no longer exist. So what about negotiations? And then somehow this little incursion into Kursk, which is an infinitesimally small percentage of the Russian territory and quite ineffectual. And as I said, is a new bleeding ground for the Ukrainian army, where they get to lose even more people even faster, and even more tanks and even more artillery. Well, what that will end up is the Russian military taking over the neighboring Sumy region, which is up till now has been Ukrainian, but will no longer be. So there'll be a contiguous bunch of Russian land going from the Black Sea all the way around to Kharkiv region, Sumy region, and we'll see about Kiev. So, you know, that's how the cookie crumbles. And there, again, no negotiation, none. People who keep using that word are using it wrong. They're using it out of context.
Yeah. We had the Ukrainian Armed Force officer, Dmitry Glushenko. He said that Kiev attacked the Kursk region for the sake of hype. And even in the mind of Ukrainian, it doesn't seem that they have a reason for this attack. In your opinion, when it comes to the situation of the Ukrainian army and the situation, the political parties, the situation of Zelensky administration, why they would do with this decision to attack Russia? And what would they gain? What would be the gain for them? And right now we're seeing that Russia is advancing in Donbas region and they're getting more territory. And it seems that this attack somehow was against them, not against Russia.
Oh yeah, no, they didn't decide to attack Kursk. Who said that they decide anything ever? Russia is a vassal state of the United States. So the Americans decided that their Ukrainian stooges should attack Russian territory in order to test Russia. They have this fetish called the red line. They have the red line fetish. They believe that Russia has these things called red lines, and that if they cross them, then that's a good thing. See, you cross Russia's red line, which you painted yourself, and nothing happened. And then you can pretend that we are strong, we the United States are strong, and Russia is weak, and look, we're winning, okay? So a little incursion into Kursk region is really sad for the people who had to be evacuated, who lost their livestock and their fields, who will have to spend the winter with friends or family or in a refugee center, although they're being very well taken care of. There are also some really unspeakable war crimes that the Ukrainians have committed. A lot of, not a lot, but quite a few of the Ukrainians who decided to surrender instead of just dying like they ought to, turned out to have photos and video on their phones showing them executing Russian non-military people, just basically peaceful inhabitants. So those are unspeakable war crimes, and they make the Russians, of course, even more upset, make even more Russian men volunteer for military service, which is actually lucrative. You know, it's almost a way to get rich for quite a lot of Russians. If you're a truck driver and you enlist in the military, suddenly your income goes up by a factor of five or something like that. So it's not like they're very resistant to doing that. But what does that have to do with the United States, this little incursion? Well, they get to waste a lot more of the weapons that they gave to the Ukrainians. So theoretically, the military industrial complex should be happy because they'll get new orders. They're always happy to get their stuff destroyed for no apparent reason, because then they can reorder. They got this red line thing ticked off. Look, we stepped on Russian soil and there was no nuclear war. So hooray, we're winning. Isn't that wonderful? So I don't know, but this, I think, shows the extreme incompetence and stupidity that is rampaging across Washington these days. They just don't understand that what would trigger a nuclear confrontation with Russia is something that the Russians perceive as an existential threat. Now, the Russians do not see maybe 100 square kilometers of the southernmost part of the Kursk region, which is nice and pastoral and has lots of fields and gullies and little rivers and things. It's pleasant. But there is nothing of strategic importance there. There is no chance that Russia would consider an invasion of the south of the Kursk region, which has now been stopped, as anything like an existential threat. So what's Russia's response? Obviously to stop the invasion, to kill the invaders, to destroy all of their equipment, and then to set up a buffer zone across the Sumy region, maybe the entirety of the Sumy region, to make sure that there's no chance of invasion again. Also, there's a conversation starting in Russia that there isn't really much of a border defense in Russia like there was in the Russian Empire. In the Russian Empire, there were these Cossack regiments. They were almost, they're Russian, but they had a kind of a massive Turkic element to it. They were ethnically mixed. They were a law unto themselves. They had their own system of democracy, so they could not really be directly governed. But they served the Tsar, they served the Emperor, and they would die defending Russia's borders. They would die willingly to do that because it was a question of honor for them. So the Russians are mulling over the thought of bringing those back, which would make Russia's borders much better defended. But there's still a question whether that's necessary.
Yeah. Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov, he said that the president has made a decision. I'm firmly convinced that everyone will be severely punished for what happened in the Kursk region. And do you think before this attack on the Russian soil, we had Lavrov talking about a symmetrical response to what the United States is doing in Ukraine? Do you think part of this response is going to be arming all the groups that there have in the Middle East, I don't know, somewhere else, to respond to the United States?
Well, Russia has made no secret of its support for Iran, and Iran has an issue with Israel. Ansar Allah probably gets, in Yemen, probably gets some war material from Iran. From what I understand, it's possible to load a truck in Iran full of war material and drive it all the way to Yemen and nobody will stop you. And I'm sure quite a bit of that is happening. And I'm sure that, you know, Russia will continue doing whatever it can to thwart America's efforts to remain relevant around the world. As it stands, you know, the Israel, which is a United States proxy in the Middle East, hasn't been able to win the war, you know, in Gaza, struggling with it for almost a year now, trying to start a similar action in Lebanon would probably be not just an impasse, but a defeat. And then if you take into account the fact that both the Iranians and the Houthis are sort of slowly getting ready to take revenge on Israel, but not really rushing, all of that is part of the same picture, which is nobody's in any hurry because everybody knows how that's going to end up. The last I heard from Yemen is their leadership said, we're in no rush to take revenge on Israel because revenge is something that has to be very delicately constructed. All of the details have to be in place. So we're in no hurry. So they're basically keeping Israel very, very tense, and they can do that for a long time. So I think that, you know, the response will be, I don't know if it'll be symmetrical, because I don't think Russia is going to organize some kind of a proxy country and slaughter its men fighting the Americans anywhere, because Russia doesn't do things like that. Russia is not into war crimes, but there will be a response, and I have issues with the word symmetrical. I think symmetry works in, you know, three dimensions, but we're dealing with many more dimensions than that.
Yeah, and how about the European Union? Let me play a clip from Borrell, Joseph Borrell.
Putting ourselves in the game. We are part of the game. We are not part of the war, but we are part of the conflict. And the way the conflict will be solved will affect our peace and security.
Yeah, I didn't want to mention Hungary, not to ruin your beautiful Friday morning. But still, to your designated successor, Kaja Kallas, it's obvious that if Germany, as we learned today, because of these budgetary rules that you're so very much...
Yeah. How do you see right now the European Union, and how much of this problem that has happened in the Kursk region is coming from the responsibility of for this attack is coming from the European Union?
The European Union doesn't make decisions like that. That's Washington. The European Union just does what it's told. People like Borrell don't necessarily know what's going on, but they make nice mouth music and sound like they're supportive of whatever is going on. Kaja Kallas is even sillier. You know, I can't wait for her to keep making fools of herself. But none of that means anything as far as Kursk. Basically, you know, the whole Kursk invasion makes absolutely no tactical or strategic sense from the Ukrainian point of view. The only thing that makes sense is the Americans decided to push the Ukrainians to directly attack Russian territory to see what happens, just as an experiment. And to the Americans, the fact that 4,000 Ukrainians died, or the fact that lots of Russians, several hundred thousand Russians, have lost their place to live, at least temporarily, means absolutely nothing. These people don't care about things like that. They care about phantoms in their own heads, like red lines. And, oh, look, we poked Russia a little bit and still no nuclear war. Hooray. That proves that Russia is weak and we're strong. Let's celebrate. Let's smoke crack. You know, that's basically the American attitude towards the whole thing. And that's where it's coming from. And where it's going is that the Ukrainians are going to get kicked out of the Kursk region, and the Russians are going to occupy Sumy region and stay there forever.
Zelensky is asking for long-range missiles, and he said, even if we had these missiles, we couldn't go with that plan of attack on the Kursk region. But do you think that at the end of the day, they're going to get it and they're going to get the permission to attack Russia?
It doesn't matter.
That would escalate. Don't you think?
It wouldn't escalate. The Russians are very good at shooting down them. So the Americans don't have anything that the Russians haven't learned to shoot down. Recently, there was attack by the Americans, because the Ukrainians don't know how to shoot these things, on the bridge, on the Crimean bridge. 12 very expensive missiles were fired in the direction of the Crimean bridge. And the Russian police had to stop traffic on the bridge for several hours while their air defense systems fired rockets and shot down all 12 of those multi-million dollar American missiles, HIMARS missiles. And then traffic resumed because there are a lot of people driving to or from beaches in Crimea because it's vacation season in Russia. So that's basically the effect of this very expensive rocketry on the Russians. Again, the Americans are happy because they get to reorder these missiles. You know, the defense movie is ecstatic that their stupid missiles are getting used up because they get to build more. But that's the only effect. The Russians have gotten very good at shooting all of that junk down.
With the situation in Ukraine and the way that Americans and Russians are dealing with each other, do you think, is there any sort of future? Is the United States thinking of the future, the day that this conflict is over? Do they imagine any sort of relationship between the United States and Russia? Because the way that we're witnessing the escalation, it's getting out of the hand.
Oh, well, you know, this whole conflict is not that important. I mean, what's Ukraine? It's some little destitute little country somewhere. Well, it's a big country, but by Russian standards, it's not even that huge. What's really going is that the United States is bankrupt, and that in Kazan, in Tatarstan, this October, there's going to be a meeting where most likely a new way of trading will be unveiled for all of the BRICS members. And keep in mind that 49 countries have filed the paperwork to join BRICS. And once that system is put in place, the United States is out of action, because the United States is non-functional without the US dollar being used internationally. And so that's what everyone is waiting for. Now, once that happens, the United States will not have any money for anything except Social Security and a few other social programs. And even that is not going to last very long. So the United States is going to fold, and everybody's waiting for that. So nobody's in any hurry, and God forbid, making some kind of an agreement with the United States. Forget that. Nobody trusts them anymore. Everybody is just waiting for the United States to fold up and, you know, pack up and go home. And so there's really no rush.
Is there any sort of discussion in the domestic media of Russia, in the mainstream media of Russia, talking about the presidential election in the United States? Is there any difference that they're drawing in terms of the two political parties in the United States, and which one would be more aggressive, less aggressive?
In Russia, it's viewed as a circus.
Yeah.
So the various candidates are basically seen as circus animals. It's understood that these people decide absolutely nothing, that they're just silly fronts. It's also understood that the people who actually do make the decisions are sort of old and senile and not really together anymore. So I think there's an appreciation for just how decrepit and degenerate the United States has become. But as far as this contest, you know, the thing with Biden being sidelined and him sticking everybody with Kamala, and then the Democratic establishment handing to Kamala this loser Waltz, who's just a ridiculous character. And the whole thing is just silly and petty and ridiculous, and the Russians are really enjoying looking at this silly nonsense going on. What it's helping do is cement the idea in the heads of Russians that American-style democracy is a complete and utter joke. They're watching this every night. There's a little segment, usually, you know, 5 minutes or less, devoted to the election in the United States. And it's like the comedy part of the news hour. Seriously, it's just like a bunch of idiots jumping up and down with flags and signs and this stupid woman grinning like a mad woman, which is what she is, either that or she's drunk. And you know, that's basically what American democracy is to the Russians.
We know that Azerbaijan is asking for joining BRICS, and that is huge when it comes to the conflict in the Middle East, because we know Azerbaijan is so important for Israel. And if they can put some pressure on Israel, they can put pressure on the United States as well, because we know the Israelis have some sort of leverage under the U.S. foreign policy as well. And how do you see, first of all, how do you see Azerbaijan joining BRICS in terms of geopolitical issues?
Oh, that's perfectly normal. That's just business as usual. 49 countries are joining BRICS, and Azerbaijan worse than the rest of them. Why? As far as relationship with Israel, well, there was a relationship with Israel. I don't know if it's ongoing or not. As far as Azerbaijan being able to tell Israel what to do, no, forget it. Israel is in kind of on a planet of its own at this point. It's nobody wants to even stand close to it. It's toxic, especially not in a Muslim country like Azerbaijan. And so I don't think that angle is really all that important. I think what's important is that Israel still has control of the U.S. Congress, so it can keep the weapons and the money flowing. But like I said, the United States is pretty close to bankrupt, lending a third of all the money that the federal government's borrowing a third of all the money that the federal government spends is not something that can go on forever for any appreciable amount of time. And like I said, once you cut out the borrowed part, all that's left is social spending. And Israel is not part of social spending in the United States, last I checked. So bye-bye Israel. So again, it's just a matter of time. And just everybody has to wait, you know, internal waiting for the United States to fold up and Israel to fold up with it.
And getting back to the first question, Modi's visit to Ukraine, we know that in Bangladesh we had a color revolution. How is it that, because do you think that they're trying to put some pressure on India on their attitude? Because he went to Russia before, and we saw what has happened, how he was welcomed in Russia. And how do you see right now he's going to Kiev right after this color revolution? Do you think that they're receiving some sort of pressure from the United States?
Okay, in Bangladesh, the color revolution was, first of all, the result of, it was in Bangladesh, right?
Bangladesh, yeah.
Yes. The problem there was, first of all, that the leadership of the country was British. Similar problem with Myanmar. Too many Brits in high places spells trouble. That's a problem for a lot of these former British colonies. So that made the whole structure, political structure, weak and easily pressured. Okay. The second problem was that the Americans suddenly decided that a tiny little island offshore that belongs to Bangladesh needed to become a U.S. airstrip and military base. And Bangladesh said no, so the Bangladeshi government had to be overthrown for that reason alone, having nothing to do with India, having everything to do with that little island, and the fact that there were Brits infiltrated into the power structure in Bangladesh. Or Bangladesh, what can I say? As far as putting pressure on India, the United States can still do that. I doubt it. Modi is just being wonderful and peaceful and going around and hugging everybody and just being lovable. I guess he enjoys doing that, and Indians love it. They lap it up. So why not do that? As far as actually producing peace, I don't think that that's really necessary. I don't think that. You know, there's really any reason to rush with that. I mean, 1.5 million dead Ukrainians versus 2 million dead Ukrainians at this point is kind of in the wash. So it's like when a huge building is on fire, it may be too late to call on the fire department. Yes, they could stand around with hoses and maybe get hurt, or maybe the safest course of action is to just let it burn to the ground, because then there'll be less work for the bulldozing crews afterwards. And that's how I see the Ukraine now. Just let it burn out.
When it comes to BRICS, and the way we recently learned that they're going to have a new system similar to SWIFT, and how long does it take, in your opinion, to everybody's, each and every country that is part of BRICS using this system?
Well, it's a big secret what they will actually unveil. There's already a replacement or replacements for SWIFT, and a lot of them interoperate. So the Russians have one, the Chinese have one, they work together. Iran, I think, has one as well. And so there's a kind of a patched together system right now for circumventing the US dollar in international trade. But what's really needed is more of a conceptual network that will, framework that will include everyone at once. That will be something that everybody can sign up for. There were various plans, white papers published. There was one called the Unit, which is a blockchain-based, decentralized way to for various countries to make currency exchange transparent between them. It's different from a currency swap, because in a currency swap you have to actually allocate the currency. You have to emit enough currency to fund the swap. And in this case, you wouldn't even have to go through that funding step. So you wouldn't be swelling the monetary base by the amount of foreign trade, which is a problem. Now, the United States can swell its monetary base ad infinitum, but small countries find that difficult to learn. Yeah, impossible. So this would get around that problem. But we have to wait. We have to wait. The element of surprise is invaluable. You don't really want to show everybody your cards ahead of time. But people are working on it, and it'll probably be interesting.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dimitri, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.